gave his Iron Curtain speech.
Uh-huh. And
not that I was conscious of it.
I was going to say that. I remember that too, but only from films, you know, things like that. And did you grow up in Fulton?
No, mm-hmm. I left there before I was conscious of anything. Grew up in Alabama, Arkansas, Virginia, Texas.
This might have had something to do with your father's occupation?
Yes, he was a preacher.
He was a preacher?
Yeah.
But for what denomination?
Presbyterian, Southern Presbyterian.
And where did you go to high school?
Went to high school in Dallas, Texas. 1 year at North Dallas High School, mm-hmm. 2 years at Hillcrest High School.
Mm-hmm. And you didn't happen to be in Dallas in trying to figure out your age in November of 1963?
I was a 62 graduate. Uh-huh. Hillcrest.
Okay. That was a tricky way of getting you to tell me when you graduated high school. Is it?
Well, you could have worked it out.
I know. But where did you go to college? Did you go straight on to college from high school?
I went straight to college. Mm-hmm. I did 1 year at Austin College in Sherman, Texas, mm-hmm. and found it totally boring except for one class, and so I transferred in my sophomore year to what was then called Florida Presbyterian College in St. Petersburg, Florida.
You chose it because it was a liberal arts denominational college?
Yeah, and because it was a new college that had a reputation for being innovative and having mm-hmm. a stimulating faculty. And I graduated there in 1966.
Did it have a stimulating faculty?
It did.
It did?
Very good.
And the one class that you liked?
The one class that I liked was psychology. I had gone in with probable engineering as, I don't know what I would have done as my major, some sort of science major, and then gone on to engineering, and I had a totally boring calculus teacher and made C's in his class, and sort of a so-so physics teacher, and the psychology professor was really tops, so that was one of a number of major shifts that I went through before I finally graduated in humanities with emphasis in philosophy and art.
In 1966.
66.
What brought you to the attention of IBS or vice versa?
I don't know if you've ever heard of a folk singing duo, Bill Addis and Steve Crowfoot. Addis and Crowfoot. They are...
I mean, I have heard of them, but...
Not one of the groups that became really famous mm-hmm. ever, mm-hmm. but they did a good bit of traveling the world back in the 60s during the folk revival, mm-hmm. and one of the things that they did was to go to Vietnam on a State Department-sponsored trip, and while they were in Vietnam, they were linked up with a Vietnamese guy named Pham Sui.
Oh, by the way, could you spell Vietnamese names just for the person
sure,
who's transcribing?
Right. Yeah. And that's Pham, and then Duy. Pham Sui was a Viet Minh veteran who had gone over to the South after 1954, but in his Viet Minh years he had done a lot of collecting of Vietnamese traditional songs mm-hmm. and writing songs of his own in the style of Vietnamese folk songs. And they had worked with him on translations of some of those into English. And those were some of the things that they were singing during the concert that mm-hmm. they gave at Florida Presbyterian. Mm-hmm. And they hung around after the concert just for an informal Q&A session. And so, because of the headlines and the, I don't remember whether we can say it was impending. I don't remember whether it came to pass or not. But there was a lot of talk at that point about ending the draft exemption for college students. Mm-hmm. So Vietnam was much on our minds at that time, and they said that of all the things that they had seen on their tour, the one thing that was really positive and hopeful in what they had seen was the work that this small group called International Voluntary Services was doing. So that was around the time that I was also applying to the Peace Corps. Either I would have been in Bolivia when Che Guevara was killed, mm-hmm. or I would have been in Vietnam, mm-hmm. depending on whether I went with Peace Corps or IBS, as it turned out. And I chose IBS because I wanted to see the Vietnam thing for myself firsthand.
But you were also obviously interested in doing some overseas work.
Yeah.
You have any sources for that? Why you made that decision?
What? No.
No?
No. I don't know. I can't even remember whether it was a matter of wanting to do stuff overseas or wanting to do... I think to a lot of people in my generation, the Peace Corps was kind of a secular incarnation of the missionary tradition. Mm-hmm. And having grown up in the church, I was sort of steeped in this idea of those who have being of service to those who have less. Mm-hmm. So there probably was a certain amount of that involved.
John F. Kennedy didn't transform you by his inaugural speech, ask not.
Could have been involved in that, but I mean, that there again, that was not a domestic versus overseas
That's
kind
right.
of thing. Mm-hmm. We did have a curriculum that put a good bit of emphasis. There was a core curriculum, which was like a double course that went through freshman and sophomore years. Mm-hmm. I came in the sophomore year of it, and then was a single credit thing through the junior and senior years. Mm-hmm. That had a fairly broad-ranging look at civilizations and cultures. Mm-hmm. So it left us kind of attuned to a world wider than just the United States. Mm-hmm. First 2 years were Western civilization and culture. The junior year was an Asian-focused mm-hmm. thing at that time, and the senior year was just more of an issues kind of thing. The basic premise of the core curriculum was to take you in your freshman year, totally strip away everything you thought you knew mm-hmm. about life and the world and values. And then over the course of the next 3 years, help you build a foundation of knowledge and analytical ability so that you could construct your own set of values as independent as possible mm-hmm. of preconceptions. Probably a false premise psychologically, but still a really interesting approach to education.
And so you have this amalgam of things that made you think that maybe the Peace Corps would be interesting, but the Peace Corps was, in competition with the Peace Corps was the fact that if you went with IBS, you could get to go to Vietnam.
Right.
Okay, now, why would you have been interested in going to Vietnam then?
Because of the war, and I had been paying attention to that for some time in my junior year as my final paper in that Asian Studies course. Mm-hmm. I had done a critique of a State Department white paper that was justifying the U.S. position in mm-hmm. Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And I'd come to the conclusion that it was totally unjustified, that we were absolutely ignoring lessons that should have been learned from the French experience. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that had developed a fairly sharp interest in mm-hmm. Vietnam.
But why go there in particular? Did you have a feeling that it
was... Well, I'm from Missouri.
Yeah, exactly.
Show me.
Thank you.
I appreciate that.
I'm glad I didn't have to spell it out for you. But as Oliver Stone said, you know, he said he thought that this was going to be the war of his generation, and he wanted to see it. But then, of course, it was a full-blown war.
So much interested in seeing the war, and mm-hmm. I stayed as far away from the war as uh-huh. I could, frankly. Yeah. I mean, uh-huh. it came to visit during the Tet Offensive, uh-huh. and I've got tape recordings of it in stereo from my living room window, but the war was not what I was interested in. I was mm-hmm. interested in what Vietnam was.
And how did you encounter IBS? That is, how did you? We know that this group
somehow
mentioned it. Yeah,
somehow but. I tracked down. I don't even remember how I tracked down what their address was.
Mm-hmm.
It's possible that Addison Crowfoot had that with them and had passed it on to those of
mm-hmm.
us who might have been interested, or I don't really remember where I got
mm-hmm.
the address, but I just wrote off to them cold
mm-hmm.
and got information and applied.
And they said, oh, well, happy to have you on board. What did you get your BA in? What was your actual degree?
Humanities.
And you graduated in?
66.
66. So you they said, well, come on down to Harper's Ferry?
There was an interview process
mm-hmm.
before that.
Mm-hmm.
A fellow named John Hughes
yes, sir.
Was my
right.
interviewer. Uh-huh. And I've forgotten where it was we met that summer in between college and IVS. I was doing a stint as a photographer for a civil rights organization. It was based in Louisville, Kentucky, so we might have met there. I don't remember.
And your interest in the civil rights movement was?
Just a justice interest,
mm-hmm.
basically. And the hookup with this particular group, which was the Southern Conference Educational Fund,
mm-hmm.
which was at the time, the only surviving offshoot of a 1930s era organization, the Southern Conference for Human Welfare. I've forgotten what
mm-hmm.
the parent organization, which had since ceased to exist,
mm-hmm.
had been. And my connection to them had come from my art professor, Margaret Rigg, who had known the people who were involved with that somehow or other.
Mm-hmm.
And the two key people were a couple, Carl and Ann Braden,
mm-hmm.
who were best known in Kentucky for having faced a sedition charge after they bought a house in a white neighborhood on behalf of a black family.
Mm-hmm. Destroying the moral fabric of America.
Something like that.
Yes, of course,
right.
Today it's gay marriages or something. And
But the Harper's Ferry
thing came.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And John may have interviewed you when you were on that assignment.
He interviewed me sometime
during
that period, and possibly in Louisville, but I don't remember.
So
sure.
When did you arrive at Harper's Ferry?
Oh boy. The box that has that
uh-huh.
information is deep in
uh-huh.
the stack of file boxes.
Good. We want that out eventually. Which
but I went out to Vietnam in October, which suggests that the Harper's Ferry was probably September
right.
of 66.
So, were you an educationist, a community development?
I did education. I was doing English as a foreign language. We did a quick training at a school in Washington where
mm-hmm.
they showed us that it's possible to teach a language without translating by putting us through a couple of hours of Russian. So I can
mm-hmm.
still say "Eta ni kniga, eta karindash," but I can't
mm-hmm.
remember what that
yes,
means.
Yes, I don't know what karindash. That's not a book. That's
it's a pencil
or
something
like
that.
Yeah.
But I understood it
you
at
understand.
The time.
And this had a name. This process, you know.
Yeah, the
audiolingual. Yes, sir.
Is what they were using. Well, they were
yeah,
using audiolingual at
that
place,
point,
and.
Yeah.
They had a very good textbook that they had developed, which
mm-hmm.
I later used in other places, and at some point lost, and wish I hadn't lost, because none of the commercial books are done as well as theirs was. Mm. They had a very explicit approach that they called backward build-up, which is intended to preserve the proper inflection of a sentence as you're teaching it.
Mm.
If you start with the first words and add words on at the back end of a sentence, mm-hmm. you mess up the intonation and confuse the student.
Hmm.
If you start at the back of the sentence and add words toward the front, your intonation is more likely to be correct as you build toward the full sentence. Hmm. So I have seen nothing that follows that in any of the commercially produced materials that I've shopped through in other times and other places.
Hmm. Was it that Georgetown?
No, it was a commercial school that was somewhere in the DuPont Circle area okay. in Washington. I don't remember the name of the school anymore.
Oh, I mean, that's easy to and find
it,
out.
Well, it may not. Yeah, it may not exist anymore.
Oh, yeah, but he'll know the name of what it was.
Yeah.
So you had that training, but it was still at Harper's Ferry, and then...
No, that was in Washington at
that
school.
Well, that's what I meant after.
At the Harper's Ferry, we had that.
The training, and then...
And then a jet to Japan mm-hmm. and a day or two in Hong Kong mm-hmm. and then Saigon.
Did you buy anything in Hong Kong? I was just curious.
I bought a lens in Japan. Uh-huh. I had the camera mm-hmm. already going out, right. But I did buy a lens in Japan, if I remember right.
Do you remember people in your group? Any people in your group? You don't have to, by the way. They'll come
Diana
to you.
Gardner uh-huh. was one of the people who was in that same group. Mm-hmm.
She lives in Washington now?
Right.
She's married
Dan
to...
Dan Bowie.
Dan Bowie?
Diana Bowie.
I mean, B-U-I.
B-U-I.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And was working for some refugee related group.
I was hoping you'd know the name
time.
Of that group, because I'm trying to track that down.
Donald, no.
But Donald, no.
And there's a woman named Kathy something who left in bad mental state after, I think, less than a year. Last name started with a B. I can't remember what that was. Tom Amiano, who's now a city council member in San Francisco, was part of my group.
And the best-looking 50-year-old man in high heels that I've ever seen. See the picture?
I have not seen him.
It's an amazing photograph. It's something like Hunk of the Month. It's on Chris's refrigerator. And it is unbelievable.
Yes. Chris had gone out earlier, and he was in a different group mm-hmm. anyway.
But he also met Diane along the way, but I don't think she wasn't his group either.
Right.
Couldn't have been.
But there were about 12 of us, and in that group that went out at the same time and mm-hmm. was going to be teaching English. Boy, and Tom's lower Montclair, New Jersey accent mm-hmm. was really an interesting twist on the English teaching thing. There was somebody mm-hmm. in that same group whose name escapes me now who was from Upper Montclair, New Jersey,
mm-hmm.
and of course had the very blue blood kind of approach to English. So it's a real contrast.
Chris had a very funny story about Tom during the Tet Offensive where he yelled at a helicopter something like, "You're going to Nha Trang?" And he said, "Well, we're going to Nha Trang, yes." And he said, "That's fine," or whatever, in this thick New Jersey accent. And he was hiding in a water tower, and which he must have learned from seeing Stalag 17, I realize, where they hide the Allied pilot they're trying to protect in the prisoner of war camp in inside the water tower.
Oh.
We've got to ask him. I got his phone number from Chris, and I'm going uh-huh. to try to interview him. What was your first impression when you arrived in Vietnam?
Well, one of the first things we did, Don Bluth was the director at the time, and he and some of the others took us out for Tit Bob Imon, the Seven Ways of Beef. So that was it was sort of a excellent food in a slummy situation. Because it was one of these open air dirt floored restaurants that was huge off on some back street out near the airport. I can't really remember first impressions because so many other impressions crowded in on those right now. It was I tell you what, I can remember one first impression very strongly, and that was the way that you landed at Tansinet Airport in those days. You came in a very tight spiral down from altitude to make your landing. No glide paths here.
Because, well, that would take you over all sorts of hostile provinces, because
right,
there's no question about that. Yes, we're going to glide past War Zone D, then we're going on to Coochie, and then Long Island.
Plain of Reeds.
That's right, this is our which is, of course, what you do now. I mean, you see, in fact, you can always tell you're flying over Coochie if you look down, and it's the only thing from 30,000 feet. Actually, you're not that high then, it's about 20, 15, but it's the only place where you can see B-52 bomb craters.
Still.
It's just... Well, they preserved it, you know, it's like a Disneyland. And the craters are there for you to look at, so you can see them. But you can't see any in the surrounding, as much in the surrounding area, but that's the only area. Because they discovered that B-52 strikes could take out the tunnel complex. By then the war was over.
Or at least make you deaf.
Well, no, by then the war was over, though. In other words, the tunnels were no longer as significant as they used to be. And so it was kind of closing the barn door after the cows had left. But it's an interesting thing. You haven't been back to Vietnam?
The latest I've been back was 88. I've made a point of, I don't remember seeing that. Okay.
Let's say we'll come back and we'll talk about that. So you had your first meal in Vietnam.
I don't know whether that was the first one, but that was the first memorable one.
And then you were staged in at the IVS house near the airport.
Right.
And were you then given your assignment, or were you given more language training, or?
At that point, we may have had some quick orientation in Saigon, but we went to Dalat for language training, which was really idyllic.
Oh, yeah.
And exactly when that was, I don't remember, but it was during the university vacation, so we were able to use one of the classroom buildings at the university as our dormitory, and another classroom in a nearby classroom building for our classes, and had the chance to go into town to see if we were actually learning anything by trying to order food in the restaurant and things like that. Studying with a teacher who was from northern Vietnam, so we were initially learning the northern accent. I later went to the Mekong Delta and found that I couldn't understand a thing. The tones were different, the vowel values seemed different, a lot of the consonant values were different. And so I spent a good bit of my first few weeks at my assignment trying to relearn what I had already learned in the class. We had 6 weeks, 6.5 days a week, 5.5 days a week. I think our days were, I've forgotten, something like 6 hours of classes. Which for me was basically enough to get used to the idea of a tonal language. Didn't really give me a level of Vietnamese that was particularly useful.
And where were you assigned when you finished with school?
So my work assignment then was down in the Mekong Delta, mm-hmm. and a town that was then on the maps as Vinh Binh, V-I-N-H, B-I-N-H. Mm-hmm. The older name and the name that it's known by now is Tra Vinh, T-R-A-V-I-N-H. It was a provincial town at the time. That town has since been, that province has since been merged into Vinh Long province, V-I-N-H-L-O-N-G. It's the province that is in between the two biggest branches of the Mekong River, so it's very easy to pick out on a map of the Mekong Delta as the tongue of land coming down between those two big branches of the river. And I've forgotten there was some delay, and I don't remember whether I spent the time of the delay in Saigon or down in Kantha, C-A-N-T-H-O, the Mekong Delta Regional Center. I may have spent some in both as arrangements were being worked out for the assignment to the school and for housing and so forth. And then even after a house was rented, it took some while. A family moved out of the house into a different house, my landlord's family, so that I could move in. But he had had the house set up with sort of a loft in it. Well, I didn't need that much room, mm-hmm. and so the loft had somehow been set up using lumber, which he could remove and use in the house that they were moving to. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons that all this move came about, rather than what would have been a simpler thing of my moving into, say, the house that he moved into, mm-hmm. rather than his moving out with all of his family so I could move into his house, mm-hmm. was that the part of town that was considered secure for a foreigner to live in, an American to live in, was relatively small. So I had to be housed in that area. And I'm just remembering now that in the interim, there was about a month's period where I was living in a house that was rented by USAID. Mm-hmm. And so I was sharing that house with some people who were AID staff. And at that time, AID and the American Medical Association were jointly sponsoring a project that put doctors in Vietnamese hospitals, mm-hmm. for volunteer stints that were, I think, about a month long. Mm-hmm. So there were a couple of those AMA doctors in that house at the time, too. But I was glad when I was able to get out of an official U.S. government
house. Which raises an issue that we all talk about, which is IVS seemed to be doing some good work in Vietnam. When you got to Harper's Ferry, or even before then, when you talked to John Hughes, you'd know that IVS was under contract to USAID to do the work that was being done.
I'm sure that was mentioned, mm-hmm. somewhere in the process. Yeah.
And what was your attitude about that, and not necessarily directly about that, but about the U.S. presence in Vietnam and how you interfaced with it? I put that in quotes.
Yeah, I know that I wanted to establish my identity as a person independent of the U.S. presence. Mm-hmm. And so all along there was some level of separation there, as much as, now I'm about to say as much as I could maintain, but there was, for the first number of months that I was there, I went to the evening unclassified briefings at the MACV, Military Assistance Command, advisory compound. And I gradually tapered off and started going there only to pick up mail because we were using the APO facilities. It was both more reliable and more confidential than going through international mail, so I didn't have any great qualms about exploiting that fact. So I can't remember what my motivation was for tapering off. Imagining back, I would imagine that it had to do primarily just with wanting to be seen with other Americans as little as possible. Was there was one Air Force doctor who was working at the local civilian hospital who also rode a bicycle around town. I was the only American who was out on the streets unarmed and did not have a weapon at all. The MACV regulation was that all official Americans in town were to carry weapons. So these were things that obviously set me apart. I was, I mean, obviously I was doing a somewhat different kind of work from what other people were doing. And even though the house that I was living in was a very nice house by Vietnamese standards and even by Florida standards, say, I still was living a much simpler life than other Americans were, and I was going out to a Vietnamese restaurant where you paid by the month and had a set menu meal for lunch and dinner, and there were all sorts of people who wanted to be your friend because you had a long nose, and then if they found out that you weren't going to buy stuff for them at the PX, then they just sort of never stopped by again. So, you know, little things like this would sort of gradually set you apart from the other Americans in people's eyes. At some point in some discussions, it was pointed out, too, that this was one of the, that being, how was it pointed out? That IVSers were much less likely than official Americans to be the targets of terrorist attacks.
That was just an impression you had?
This was somehow pointed out in conversations within IVS, and I can't remember whether somebody made an official point of it, like in an orientation kind of session, or whether this was just something that came to be known within the group.
You were almost the only American, well, you were almost the only non military American or USAID American in this town. Who did you talk to?
Primarily to a fairly small group of people I got to know who were Vietnamese. Mm-hmm. There were other teachers I worked with, and after some sort of security problem at the place where he had been living, one of the teachers that I worked with actually shared the house where I was living. Mm-hmm. I got to know the families on either side, and in fact, one of my best Vietnamese teachers was a 12-year-old girl in one of those families who would come over. Well, she would come out to the fence every time I came back home from going out somewhere and force me to speak with her in Vietnamese, and I got her to come over and help me label things around the house with the words for their names. And there also was a family on the other side. The son was in the army. The father had a small trucking operation just to bring goods from Saigon down into the Delta and run stuff around the Delta. And that had been affected by the war. It was still in operation, but the father was not driving at that point. And so there were three generations living in that house, the father and his wife, and the son and his wife, and their little daughter. And the family on the other side was also a three-generation family.
And what exactly was your assignment? Did you teach at a normal school, or did you teach?
I was teaching in a provincial high school, teaching primarily first-year students, teaching some there were, the schools were organized, the high schools were organized with two sections. It was sort of a junior high school, middle school age group, and a senior high school age group. So I was teaching mainly classes in the lowest, the first year of that junior high middle school range, the seventh year in the counting backwards way of the French-based school system. And I had some classes in the third year counting backwards, so sophomore year, essentially.
And did you develop, and you mentioned the teacher who came and lived, did you develop any close relations with any of the other teachers?
I don't know that you could say it was really close. I had good, friendly working relationships, especially with about three of the teachers. But I didn't have a really good sense of who was who and how the structure of the school worked, and I'm not sure they had any really clear sense of what I could do and how they could use me. They were just stretched by the need to keep the school going when they didn't have enough teachers and they didn't have enough resources of any kind. I was sort of assuming, I think, when I went in that I would probably be a supplemental teacher, and I wound up, as it happened, being the only English teacher for some of these first-year students that I was teaching, the year seven students, and wound up being responsible for their exam, their entire grade, and despite the fact that I was coming in halfway into the semester, and they apparently had been going without an English teacher at all for the previous part of the semester. I also, at some point, wound up teaching some classes at a...
This is my bad knees. I need to keep shifting around.
At a semi-public school that was partly supported by government funds and partly supported by some sort of fee structure. And that was at that sort of sophomore level class. And in those classes, I definitely was a supplementary teacher. I wasn't their only teacher, fortunately for them. Seventh year classes were huge classes. I think of, I'm thinking 50 students in a class. It may have been a bit larger. The upper level classes were smaller just because of the attrition, which was pretty fierce through the school years. I mean, at that time, the only high school level school, I think, in the province, and there were these two, were in the provincial capital. The only thing out in the province was grade school level. So it meant that anybody who wanted to go to the higher level schools had to make arrangements to live in town somehow, as well as passing the exams to get in the school in the first place. And so that was a limiting factor. And there may have been some who just didn't make it for academic reasons, so there was a lot of attrition as you moved up the grade levels.
And did you get, what kind of rapport did you develop with those students? I mean, obviously these are, how would you characterize them?
We managed to overcome chaos in occasional circumstances. I think that some of them were learning some things. I have no good sense of how much they learned. Some of them did react in a friendly way. Others, I don't know what their reaction was. I think a lot of it depended on how they saw me, the extent to which they saw me as an American, and the extent to which they saw me as just a person who happened to be an American. I mean, there were some incidents with neighbors and with students that made it clear to me that there were at least a handful of people who didn't see me as an American, specifically. The truck driver's granddaughter, when I first arrived, every time I came to the house, if she was outside, she would go running back into their house. And after a while, she became quite friendly, and her grandfather said to me one time, she used to think that you were an American, and she was very scared, and now she thinks that you're a teacher. Or there was another time when I was going shopping for something, and the 12-year-old from the other family was going with me for some reason, so she was riding on the back of my bicycle, and we were going through some market area where there was just the typical chorus of kids with the, "Oh me, oh me, Mr. American, Mr. American," just screaming after me, and she turned around and said to him, "He's not an American, he's a teacher." So, you know, things like that. One of the students in the higher level classes gave me just a typescript of some poems that he had written, gave them to me, as best I can remember, in just before the Tet vacation, before Tet Maltan, the 1968 Tet. And he was one of the students Well, I did not see him again. On the other hand, the school was still closed by the time that that I left a couple of months after the offensive, because transportation was still not available from Saigon and teachers couldn't get back and one thing and another. So I never knew for sure one way or another. I sort of had the feeling that he might have been one of the group of students that was that I heard made up the contingent that captured the provincial headquarters and held it until they were all killed. So, you know, there were some signs that I was, by a small group of people, seen as a person in my own right, despite my long nose and white skin.
Did you, I mean, we talked about relationships you might have had with local Americans and with Vietnamese. Did you ever go into Kanta, or, you know, in other words, interrelate with other IPSers on any regular
Yeah, and
basis?
There were, I can't remember what sort of frequency, but I would go to Kanta for meetings, or to Saigon for meetings, and on some occasions also went to visit IVSers who were working in other parts of the country, just to get a sense of what those parts of the country were like. But I didn't do that a whole lot. I tended more to stay put in my own community. I can't remember who I went to visit, but I did go to visit somebody up on the central coast once, and I can't even remember which town it was. I want to say Phantiet, Phantiet, or Phanrang, Phanrang, but I can't remember for sure. I do remember riding along some little coastal highway up a precipice. It's almost like California, except when you look down, there was this gorgeous white sand beach, the kind of sand that you see at Nha Trang, in Hatrang, where the sand is so white. That
two words.
Yeah. that the Japanese camera companies like it for optical glass. Yeah. You know. But I did tend to stay put, I think, more than some volunteers did. Maybe I was just a hermit at heart.
Maybe, but there are a lot of others that had that experience, largely for the same reasons. Did you ever come across? I mean, you were in Region 4. So did you ever come across David? David Gittleson.
Dave Gittleson. I didn't see him a lot, but I was at one meeting of the ag team, and I think I was there because during the summer vacation, school vacation, I was one of the people who was working on preparing material for the IVS annual report. So I think that was the context that took me to that meeting in Kanta.
For summer of 66?
No, that would have been 67.
Okay. Because I know Don Cohan did the 66. We all have copies of that, by the way, just by coincidence we have copies of that. I mean, the other copies of the annual report exist, but Don happened to hand that one to Paul and I when we went to see him the first time. So this was in 67.
Right.
Well, something else happened in 1967. You may have received a visit by Don Luce, who had a letter that he wanted you to...
Actually, Don
at.
Didn't proselytize. There was, or at least not in
you.
My case.
Right.
I was a signer of the letter.
I'm just getting to that. That was just a slick way of saying, you know, you remember the circumstances of that.
But I found out about the letter during some visit that I made to Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
And just in sitting down and talking in the main living room of the IVS house, because it was a frustrating time, the whole time we were there, and there was constant questioning of whether what we were doing was contributing anything to Vietnam, or whether it was all being lost in the war, and even whether we were no more than slick propaganda tools, because we were undermining a clear understanding that what the United States was doing in Vietnam was wrong. So somehow I learned about the letter and signed the letter, made sure that a copy of it got to Motive magazine, which was a student magazine that was published by the Methodist Church,
mm-hmm.
Which I had first learned about in my college days because one of the professors in the art department, Jim Crane, was a cartoonist mm-hmm. for them. And then in my senior year, the woman who had been the art director for the magazine, Margaret Rigg, came to join the faculty at the school.
Mm-hmm.
And I had had some photographs published in Motive, thanks to an introduction through Jim Crane to Margaret Rigg when she
mm-hmm.
was still there.
Right.
So I knew, or had contact with the editor, B.J. Stiles. I had had a longish letter to the editor published sometime earlier in Motive, based on some of my experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Still
have a copy of that?
Definitely do.
Mm-hmm. Not right this second,
we should. I don't know what the most efficient way to make a list of some of these things might be, but let's see, I had also gotten to him a copy of an essay that was written by a Vietnamese peacenik, published in a Vietnamese publication,
mm-hmm.
and somebody within IBS had translated it and circulated it and mimeographed within IBS.
Mm-hmm.
So they had published that as well on the basis of my having sent it to them.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I did write that letter to the editor thing for Motive. I did also at that time send a piece to Texas Presbyterian, which was a monthly newspaper type publication
mm-hmm.
That circulated within Presbyterian churches in Texas.
Mm-hmm.
And can't remember if I did any other overt rabble-rousing outside of my newsletters to friends.
Well, leading to that, well, do you have copies, by the way? Did they ever keep the copies of the newsletter that you was sent to them, give it back to you?
I kept file
kept
copies of all of that stuff.
You asked, what do I want to see?
It's deep in,
oh, that's
in
the,
my attic there.
Which
is
why I'm not
there.
Asking for you for it now, but I think
yeah.
Copies of that would be incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll be happy to foot the bill, especially if I get more money for this project.
Yeah, well, I mean, the bill is not a problem,
okay.
But if you can send me a follow-up note.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's what I plan to do. By the way, just for the fun of it, I'm sure it's on your form, but you have an email address?
Yeah, and it's
mm-hmm.
on that resume, too.
Okay. Oh, it's on the resume. Okay, great. The, before we get into the actual letter itself, you went to Vietnam in part because you wanted to know more about it, not just
mm-hmm.
the war, the Vietnam, you know, why it was in the headlines, what it would mean. And a year later, you were signing a letter saying, what the United States was doing to Vietnam was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You went for knowledge. You found out probably more than you wanted to about the war. You concluded it was wrong. What led you to that conclusion?
Well, as I mentioned earlier, I went in with a sense that the United States was ignoring lessons that it should have learned from the French experience.
What lessons were we ignoring, by the way? I don't want to recall your high school senior thesis, but... Well, let's put it this way. When you were in Vietnam, we were ignoring the lessons of the French. We were doing something wrong. What was that?
Well, I think that the point, part of the point on the lessons of the French was tactical. You know, we were carrying on the war in a way that was only going to win us enemies, not friends. I don't know at what point I started to see the whole thing as an imperial venture that that had nothing to do with the welfare of Vietnam and everything to do with what the U.S. government saw as its interest in preserving a particular vision of America's role in the world.
So there wasn't an epiphany, in other words, where something happened where you said, damn, that's what this whole war is all about.
No, because I was coming in with a certain notions of what was going on and what was right and just in the world, and what I saw about the simple physical brutality of the war, about the way that people were being driven away from productive lives into dependent lives, purely for reasons of military strategy, things that I saw about the breakdown of traditional culture under the presence of so many young American men with lots of dollars, ranging from prostitution to just black marketing and general corruption. Things that I saw about the government that we were supporting, and how people who had positions of influence in that government were using them as far as I could tell, just for their own personal interests and not for the interests of the country.
An example?
An example, I went to visit a school out in the one of the district towns, and the walkway that was sort of the outdoor hall from classroom to classroom was cement, and it was fairly new, and yet the cement was flaking off, and the reason the cement was flaking off was that the government official responsible for having the school constructed had siphoned off about half of the cement that was supposed to be in that walkway, so it was mostly sand, just held together by a little bit of cement. And yeah, that's just one incident, but it was very typical of the kinds of things that went on. And I think some of the main things that I heard, though, that had a strong emotional impact on me outside of my own experience were from people like Herb Roos, who were working with refugees and were seeing the way that the fact that there was an IVS refugee person in a province would lead the military planners to conclude that they could generate refugees there because there was somebody to take care of them. And this was, you know, the village of Ben Suk kind of stuff.
Yes. Well, did you ever get... Did you ever have confirmation for that feeling? That there being an IVSer there working with refugees would permit refugee generation?
That was not... I was the only IVSer in the province where I was working, mm-hmm. so I didn't have any direct experience of that. Only what I heard from others.
Other IVSers. Okay.
Yeah. Have you talked with Herb Bruce? Do you have him on?
He's not on my. He's not in my region, so to speak. But I can't remember. I think it was Dennis. It was Dennis
Rothar.
Dennis had a very similar experience where it was the refugee generation that had the biggest impact.
Yeah, and
that it was obvious
he was working in that area.
And he was set up rather like you were, that there was a MACV advisory section. He was doing specific work. He didn't leave the village much. He wasn't, you know, out of community development. He lived mostly alone or with Vietnamese, apart from other Americans, and occasionally went into regional centers in Saigon and things like that to connect, but mostly stayed in his own bailiwick.
Hmm.
And
I never talked with him much about his IVS experience. We worked together later in a different context.
But what's surprising is the two of you are actually the more engaging, not outgoing isn't the right word, but you're engaging people, and that you were both hermits.
Hermits.
You know? whereas those that look like your typical hermits, you know, were the ones that felt most comfortable, you know, not out there all by themselves.
Hmm.
And the gregariousness, in other words, was probably always there. But
well,
it was fulfilled in other ways than being with Americans.
I think it's, I mean, I'm in some respects a powder milk biscuit kind of person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I need to have something to give shy people the strength to do what needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, in order to develop relations with Vietnamese in a situation
mm-hmm.
like that, you have to make a point of it.
Mm-hmm.
And there were times that I would make that effort, and there were times that I would just sort of hole up in my house and read because I wasn't up to it.
You mentioned brutality. I mean, other than the refugee thing, did you hear or experience yourself or see for yourself the kinds of things that the American war was inflicting on the Vietnamese people?
Not